A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about the beach again. Not the nice part. The part where a paramedic crew's working on somebody while everyone else pretends not to look. And then you walk home with that weight in your chest and suddenly every small thing you're doing with your life feels worth examining. He says those moments of clarity never stick, which I think everyone listening knows is true. And he's been wondering whether there's a way to get that clarity on purpose. His prompt is really three questions stacked inside each other. First, what actually happens psychologically when you get one of those spontaneous death reminders? And why does the inside fade so fast? Second, how have different cultures and self-help traditions built structured mortality reflection into their practices? And what can we steal from them? And third, the one he seems most worried about getting wrong. Is there a healthy way to tap into the last day thought experiment, habitually, without sliding into dark rumination? He mentions the regrets of the dying book we've discussed before, his own superstition and avoidance, and he's asking whether this thing he's been using as a coaching tool can become a sustainable practice rather than a sporadic accident.
The beach CPR moment is a perfect example of something the research actually has a name for, and the name matters because it explains exactly why the insight evaporates. Psychologists distinguish between mortality salience and death reflection. Mortality salience is the brief reminder. You see the paramedics, you register that death is real and close, and your brain treats it as a threat. Death reflection is the deeper, slower contemplation where you actually imagine your own death in detail and think about what your life means in light of it. Those are two different psychological processes, and they produce almost opposite outcomes.
So the beach moment is salience, not reflection.
And salience triggers what's called the terror management system. The core finding from terror management theory, which has been around since the late 80s, is that when you remind people of their mortality even briefly, they don't become more philosophical, they become more defensive. They cling harder to their existing worldview, they get more hostile to people who disagree with them, they strive harder for self-esteem boosts from their own culture. The death reminder gets pushed out of conscious awareness almost immediately, and what's left is this heightened investment in whatever already made you feel safe and significant.
That's the opposite of clarity.
It's the opposite of clarity, and it's also why the beach insight doesn't last. The insight feels profound in the moment because you're consciously thinking about the fragility of life. But within minutes, the proximal defenses kick in and push the death thought out of mind. Then the distal defenses kick in and you're suddenly very attached to your existing identity, your existing projects, your existing sense of being a good person. Neither of those processes is designed to make you reevaluate your life. They're designed to make you stop thinking about death as fast as possible.
So the thing Daniel experienced as a moment of clarity was actually the brief window before the suppression kicked in.
That's my read. The clarity is real, but it's not a product of the death reminder itself. It's what happens in the gap between the reminder and the defensive response. And because the defensive response is automatic and fast, the gap is short. Half a day at most, and then you're back to your normal priorities.
But this is where the research gets interesting. Because there's a whole separate line of work showing that death reflection, the deeper kind, does something completely different. Tell me about the greed study.
Cozzolino and colleagues, 2004. They had participants do one of two things. One group just answered questions about death, which is the standard mortality salience induction. The other group did a death reflection exercise where they imagined dying in a fire in a high-rise building in vivid detail and then reflected on their life and what it meant. Then both groups completed measures of greed and intrinsic values. The mortality salience group showed the standard defensive pattern, more greed, more extrinsic striving. The death reflection group showed the opposite, decreased greed, increased intrinsic values, more concern for growth and connection and meaning.
Same stimulus, roughly, opposite outcome.
Same topic, radically different processing. That's why the dual existential systems model exists. The idea is that we have two separate psychological systems for handling death. One manages the terror, that's the terror management system, and it's all about suppression and defense. The other manages meaning, making, and growth, and that's the system death reflection activates. When you reflect on death mindfully, rather than just being reminded of it, you shift from the terror system to the meaning system.
So the question Daniel's really asking is how to reliably activate the second system without tripping the first one.
That's the whole game. And here's the complication. Spontaneous reminders almost always activate the first system because they're sudden and they feel threatening. The beach CPR moment isn't a structured reflection, it's an alarm going off. Your brain treats it like a threat to be managed, not an invitation to contemplate.
And the threat response is fast and automatic, while the meaning response is slow and deliberate. So the spontaneous reminder never gets a chance to become reflection.
Right. The insight fades because the reflection never actually happened. What happened was a brief conscious awareness followed by an automatic defensive process. Daniel thinks he had a moment of clarity, but what he mostly had was the beginning of a clarity process that got interrupted by his own threat response.
There's a wrinkle here I want to pull on. The classic terror management findings, the worldview defense effect, were meta-analyzed in 2010 by Burke and colleagues. 164 studies, robust effect. Remind people of death, they defend their worldview more strongly. But then a few years ago, a large-scale replication attempt by Traeger and colleagues failed to reproduce the classic findings. What does that do to the story we just told?
It complicates it honestly. The 2023 Traeger failure was a big deal in the field. It doesn't mean mortality salience has no effect, but it suggests the effect is smaller, more fragile, and more context-dependent than a decade of research claimed. Which is actually relevant to Daniel's question, because it means the defensive response to death reminders isn't as automatic and universal as the early theory suggested. Some people, in some contexts, might be more likely to respond to a death reminder with reflection rather than defensiveness.
So the failure to replicate is almost good news for the project Daniel's interested in.
In a weird way, yes. If the terror management response were as robust as the early literature claimed, then any attempt to use mortality reflection as a tool would be fighting against a very powerful automatic process. The fact that the effect is more fragile suggests there's more room for individual differences, for context, for the kind of structured practice that might reliably produce reflection rather than salience.
But we shouldn't overstate that. The analysis was still real, and the buffering literature is pretty consistent. People with strong meaning systems, religious belief, secure self-esteem, they show weaker mortality salience effects. They have buffers, which suggests the healthy approach isn't to strip away all your defenses and stare at death raw.
That's a crucial point. The people who handle death awareness best aren't the ones who think about death the most. They're the ones who have the strongest meaning frameworks already in place. The reflection works because it's embedded in a system of meaning, not because it's a naked confrontation with mortality.
So the culture question Daniel asked isn't a side quest. It's the core of the answer. Because what the traditions have figured out is how to structure mortality reflection so it activates the meaning system rather than the terror system.
Let's go through them because each one solves a different part of the problem. The Stoics had memento mori, the practice of remembering you'll die. Marcus Aurelius writes, you could leave life right now, let that determine what you do and say and think. But notice the structure. It's not a daily panic about death. It's a daily reminder that death is the horizon against which your action should be evaluated. The death thought is there to clarify what matters, not to frighten you.
And it's embedded in a whole ethical system. The Stoic isn't just thinking about death, he's thinking about death in the context of virtue, duty, what a good life looks like. The meaning system is already there, and the death reflection just activates it.
Buddhist Moranasati is even more explicit. Death awareness as a formal meditation practice. You contemplate the inevitability of death, the fragility of the body, the uncertainty of the time of death. But again, it's structured, it's gradual, and it's embedded in a larger framework about impermanence and non-attachment. The point isn't to be afraid of death, it's to loosen your grip on things that don't matter.
The Mexican Day of the Dead is interesting because it's collective and festive. Death is brought into the open, but through ritual, humor, family, food. It's the opposite of the beach CPR moment, where death arrives as an emergency, and you process it alone. The Day of the Dead processes death through community and celebration, which is a completely different psychological register.
And the Jewish Yom Kippur liturgy has the same structure. Once a year, you confront your mortality directly. Who shall live and who shall die? You're supposed to imagine yourself in the Book of Life or the Book of Death. But it's once a year. It's communal. It's embedded in a framework of repentance and repair. The mortality reflection is intense, but it's calibrated. It's not a daily practice. It's an annual audit.
Which brings us to the answer to Daniel's question about whether the last day thought experiment can be habitual. I think the evidence says no, not in the form he's worried about. Daily mortality salience would keep the terror management system chronically activated. You'd be in a constant state of low-grade threat response, which produces anxiety and defensive clinging, not clarity.
The research on chronic mortality salience is thinner, but the logic is clear. The terror management system is designed for acute threats. It fires, it suppresses, it defends, and then it resets. If you keep firing it every day, you never get the reset. You're just marinating in threat response.
But the traditions point to a middle path. Not daily salience, but periodic, structured reflection. The Stoics did it daily, but in a very specific way, as part of a virtue practice, not as a raw confrontation with death. The Buddhists do it as meditation, which is a trained skill, not a spontaneous thought. The Jews do it annually, intensely, communally.
And the key variable in all of them is that the death reflection is oriented toward meaning, not fear. The question isn't what would I do if I were dying today. The question is, what does my life mean, and am I living in alignment with that meaning? The death awareness is just the thing that makes the question urgent.
That's the reframe Daniel's been circling. His coaching question, what's intrinsic to who you're versus what you're doing to please others, that's a meaning question. The death thought experiment is just the lever he uses to make people take it seriously. And the research supports that the lever works, but only when it's pulled in a particular way.
Bronnie Ware's five regrets are useful here, because they're not just sad stories from a palliative care nurse. They're a diagnostic checklist. The most common regret, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. That's exactly the distinction Daniel's coaching question is trying to get at. The other four are variations on the same theme. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends. I wish I'd let myself be happier.
What strikes me about the list is that none of the regrets are about achievement. Nobody says I wish I'd closed one more deal or gotten one more promotion. They're all about authenticity and connection. Which suggests the regrets of the dying are a pretty good map of what the meaning system actually cares about, as opposed to what the terror management system defends.
That's a sharp observation. The terror management system defends your cultural worldview and your self-esteem, which are often about achievement and status and being a good member of your group. The meaning system, the one death reflection activates, is about intrinsic values, connection, growth, authenticity. The two systems care about different things, and Ware's regrets are a document of what the meaning system values.
So if you want to use mortality reflection as a tool, the first step is to ask the right question. Not what would I do if I were dying, but what am I doing that I'd regret if I were dying? That's the diagnostic frame.
And the second step is to structure it. Pick a rhythm, not daily, but periodic. Weekly, monthly, annually. Pick a format, journaling, meditation, a conversation with someone you trust, and embed it in a meaning framework, whether that's religious, philosophical, or just your own articulated values. The death thought is the catalyst, not the content.
The annual rhythm is interesting because there's some evidence that the intensity of the reflection matters more than the frequency. A single deep reflection, done properly, has more lasting effect than constant, shallow reminders. The Cozzolino study was a one-time exercise, and it produced measurable shifts in values.
Right. The death reflection group imagined their death in detail once, and it changed their greed and intrinsic values in the lab. That's a single structured exercise. You don't need to do it every day. You need to do it deeply, periodically, and in a context that supports the meaning orientation.
So the practical answer to Daniel's question is something like, pick a rhythm that works for you, make it structured, and orient it toward meaning rather than fear. The last day thought experiment can be part of that, but reframed as an audit question. What did I do this week or this year that I'm proud of? What did I do that I'd regret if I died tomorrow? And what am I going to change?
That's the shape of it. And the reason it works is that it activates the meaning system without tripping the terror system. You're not ambushing yourself with death. You're sitting down deliberately and using the awareness of death to look at your life more clearly.
The beach CPR moment fails because it's an ambush. The traditions succeed because they're appointments.
I like that. The ambush versus the appointment. That's the whole distinction in four words.
There's one more piece I want to put on the table before we move on. The buffering literature suggests that the people who benefit most from mortality reflection are the ones who already have some kind of meaning framework in place. The religion and self-esteem buffers aren't just defenses. They're also platforms. If you have a strong sense of what your life is for, then death reflection clarifies and deepens that sense. If you don't, then death reflection can be destabilizing.
That's an important caveat. Daniel's question about wading in dark territory without getting sucked into rumination, the answer is partly that the rumination happens when you confront death without a meaning framework to catch you. The traditions all provide the framework. The Stoic has virtue, the Buddhist has impermanence, the Jew has covenant and repentance. The framework is what keeps the reflection from becoming rumination.
So the order matters. Build the meaning first, then use death reflection to refine it, not the other way around.
And that's probably why Daniel's own superstition and avoidance are worth taking seriously. He's not wrong to be cautious. The people who are cavalier about death reflection are often the ones who haven't actually done it. It's dark territory. The question is whether you go in with a map.
The map being the meaning framework.
The map being the meaning framework and the rhythm and the structure. All the things the traditions figured out over centuries.
So, if spontaneous reminders don't work and daily salience would be unhealthy, what does the healthy version actually look like? Cultures have been building answers to this for thousands of years.
And the answers converge on a surprisingly consistent shape. Episodic, not constant. Structured, not spontaneous. Meaning-oriented, not fear-oriented. The Stoics, the Buddhists, the Jewish liturgy, the Day of the Dead, they all hit those three notes.
The Stoic version is probably the closest to what Daniel's already doing with his coaching clients. Marcus Aurelius wrote the meditations as a daily practice, but it wasn't a daily panic about death. It was a daily reflection on how to live in accordance with nature and virtue, with death as the background fact that gave the reflection urgency. The death thought is there, but it's not the focus. The focus is on how to act rightly today.
And the meditations are interesting because they're private. Marcus wrote them for himself, not for publication, which suggests the practice is personal and iterative. You're not performing mortality reflection for an audience. You're doing it to calibrate your own life.
The Buddhist practice is more formal. Maranasati is a specific meditation technique, and it's taught gradually, usually to monks and serious practitioners, not to beginners. The tradition recognizes that death awareness is powerful and potentially destabilizing, so it's introduced within a structured training bath.
That's a point the self-help world often misses. The traditions don't just hand you a death meditation and say good luck. They prepare you for it. They build the container first.
The Day of the Dead is the most accessible version because it's collective and joyful. Death is personified, mocked, celebrated. The skeletons are dancing. It's a way of processing mortality through community and humor, which is about as far from the beach CPR moment as you can get.
The Jewish Yom Kippur liturgy is the most intense annual version. Once a year, you spend a day confronting your mortality and your moral failures. But it's once a year, and it's embedded in a communal ritual that's been refined for millennia. The intensity is calibrated.
The answer to Daniel's question about whether the last day thought experiment can be habitual is not in the form he's worried about, but yes, in a different form. The daily version is unhealthy. The periodic, structured, meaning-oriented version isn't only healthy. It's one of the oldest human practices there is.
The research supports the distinction. The Cozzolino study showed that a single deep reflection changes values. The Traeger failure suggests the defensive response isn't as automatic as we thought. The buffery literature shows that meaning frameworks make the reflection safe. All of it points to the same conclusion. Structure and meaning are what make mortality reflection work.
Where's Regrets are the diagnostic tool that connects all of this to Daniel's coaching practice. The five regrets are a checklist for auditing whether you're living by your own script or someone else's. The first regret, the courage to live a life true to yourself, is the one that maps directly onto Daniel's distinction between intrinsic mission and performative success.
The other four are all variations on the same theme. Working too hard is about prioritizing achievement over connection. Not expressing feelings is about authenticity. Not staying in touch with friends is about connection. Not letting yourself be happier is about the courage to choose joy over obligation. They're all the same regret in different clothes.
The practical shape of a healthy mortality reflection practice would be something like this. Pick a rhythm, weekly or monthly or annually. Pick a format, journaling or meditation or conversation. And ask the audit question, what did I do in this period that I'm proud of? What did I do that I'd regret if I died tomorrow? And what am I going to change? The death awareness is the thing that makes the audit urgent, but the audit itself is about life, not death.
That's the synthesis. The goal isn't to think about death more, it's to think about life more clearly, using death as a periodic calibration tool rather than a daily companion.
The line between healthy reflection and dark rumination is the meaning framework. If you have a sense of what your life is for, death reflection clarifies it. If you don't, death reflection can pull you into a spiral. The traditions all provide the framework. The self-help version needs to build it explicitly.
Which is probably why Daniel's instinct to be cautious is right. He's not being superstitious, or not just superstitious. He's recognizing that this is powerful material, and it needs to be handled with structure and care.
The research points towards structured, episodic reflection, and it turns out Hilbert has a story about exactly that.
Margaret didn't have any regrets. I asked her. I was 22 and working the night shift at a hospice in Hartford, and I asked her straight out, "Do you have any regrets?" She said no. She was a retired school teacher, outlived everyone, husband, siblings, most of her friends. Her last few months, she spent writing letters to her former students, hundreds of letters. She'd taught for 40 years, so she had a lot of former students. I asked her how she managed to have no regrets, and she told me about her New Year's Day ritual. Every January 1st, she sat down with a notebook and asked herself two questions. What did I do last year that I'm ashamed of, and what am I going to do about it? Not what would I do if I were dying. Not what's my life mission. Just those two questions, once a year. She said one day a year was enough to keep her honest without keeping her scared. The rest of the year, she didn't think about death at all. She just lived by the answers she'd written down on New Year's Day.
That's the annual audit, exactly the shape the research points to.
The thing about Margaret's version is it sidesteps the whole death question. She wasn't imagining herself dying. She was auditing her life against her own standards. Death was just the deadline that made the audit matter. She didn't need to think about dying to know that the year was over, and she'd either done right by her students, or she hadn't.
The death awareness was implicit. It was the reason the audit mattered, but it wasn't the content of the audit.
That's it. She didn't sit there thinking about her own funeral. She sat there thinking about whether she'd been the teacher she wanted to be. The death part was just the calendar. The year ends. You don't get it back. What are you going to do about the next one?
She did this for how long?
She said she started when she was 30. So 50 years, give or take. 50 New Year's days. She said some years the list was short, some years it was long, but she never skipped it.
50 annual audits. That's a life's worth of calibration.
She said the letters to her students were the last audit, in a way. She was writing to them because she wanted them to know what they'd meant to her. That was the thing she was proud of, not the teaching itself, the relationships. She said the teaching was just the job, the students were the point.
That's the intrinsic versus extrinsic distinction, lived. She didn't regret not getting a bigger pension or a better position. She was proud of the connections.
I think about her every New Year's. I don't do the notebook thing, but I think about her.
The annual rhythm is interesting because it's infrequent enough to avoid the chronic activation problem, but regular enough to keep the calibration from drifting. Once a year, you check your course. The rest of the year, you sail.
The two-question format is elegant. What am I ashamed of and what am I going to do about it? It's backward-looking and forward-looking at the same time. It's an audit, not a fantasy. You're not imagining an ideal life. You're examining the life you actually lived.
Margaret's version also solves the rumination problem. She wasn't marinating in death awareness. She was doing a specific task, once a year, with a clear structure. The death pod was just the reason the DOS mattered.
She said the trick wasn't to make it too big. If you sit down and ask yourself, what's the meaning of my life, you'll be there all day and feel worse. But if you ask, what did I do last year that I'm ashamed of, that's a question you can actually answer.
That's the practical wisdom the research keeps pointing to. The meaning question is too abstract. The audit question is concrete.
The synthesis is something like this. The goal isn't to think about death more. It's to think about life more clearly, using death as a periodic calibration tool. The healthy version is structured, episodic, and meaning-oriented. The unhealthy version is spontaneous, constant, and fear-driven.
The open question, the thing I'm left wondering about, is what the trigger replication failure means for the whole terror management framework. If the defensive response to mortality salience is less robust than we thought, then maybe the distinction between salience and reflection is even more important than the early research suggested. Maybe the reason the beach moment fades so fast isn't just that the terror system suppresses it, but that the meaning system never got activated in the first place.
Which would mean the practical takeaway is even simpler. If you want the clarity, you have to do the reflection. Not just get reminded of death, but actually sit with it in a structured way with a meaning framework in place. The reminder alone won't do it.
That's the thing I'd want Daniel to take from this. His coaching instinct is right. The death thought experiment is a powerful tool, but it's a tool that needs a handle. The handle is the structure, the rhythm, the meaning framework. Without the handle, you're just grabbing the blade.
The blade being the raw awareness of death.
The blade being the raw awareness of death. And the traditions all figured out how to put a handle on it. That's what Memento Mori is. That's what Maranasati is. That's what Yom Kippur is. A handle on the blade.
The answer to Daniel's question is yes. The thought experiment can be tapped into habitually. But not daily, and not in the raw form. The healthy version is periodic, structured, and oriented toward meaning rather than fear. The question isn't what would I do if I were dying, but what am I doing that I'd regret if I died, and what am I going to change?
The line between healthy reflection and dark rumination is the meaning framework. If you have a sense of what your life is for, death reflection clarifies it. If you don't, it can pull you under.
The beach CPR moment will keep happening, and it'll keep being an ambush. But the appointment version, the Margaret version, the Stoic version, that's something you can build.
That's probably the thing to sit with. The goal isn't to think about death more, it's to think about life more clearly.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review or tell a friend. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com with your own prompts and questions.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.